Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning into the 303rd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a legendary self-made New York film distributor, the founder of New Line Cinema, who ran the company from its birth in a fifth-floor Greenwich Village walk-up in 1967, through it going public in 1986, through its acquisition by Ted Turner in 1994, and right through his termination by parent company Time Warner in 2008, presiding over the release of a wide variety of culturally and/or commercially significant films, including 1972's Pink Flamingos, 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street, 1990's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, 1994's The Mask and Dumb and Dumber, 1995's Seven, 1997's Boogie Nights, 1999's Magnolia, 2004's The Notebook, 2005's Wedding Crasher, and the Austin Powers Blade, Rush Hour, Final Destination, and most famously, Lord of the Rings film franchises. The recipient of the National Association of Theater Owners Career Achievement Award in 1989, a Career Tribute Gotham Award, and the Motion Picture Pioneers Pioneer of the Year Award in 1995, and the American Film Market's Lifetime Achievement Award in 2002, Bob Shea. Over the course of an emotional conversation at the New York offices of his current production company, Unique Features, the 80-year-old and I discussed his humble beginnings and evolution in the film business, how he came to know and eventually partner at New Line with Michael Lynn, who passed away in March, why his motto was always prudent aggression, and his company tended to focus on appealing to niche audiences rather than everyone, how he regarded Miramax, the other New York distribution upstart, which was founded by Bob and Harvey Weinstein, and how he navigated the ups and downs of the film distribution business for as long as he did, why, as he enters his ninth decade, he has returned to his original passion, filmmaking, directing a black swan-like thriller called Ambition, which centers on a young violinist who may be inadvertently causing the deaths of fellow musicians, and which Shout Studios released on September 20th, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Mr. Shea, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you on the podcast. Always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and my dad was trained as a lawyer. He went to law school at night, I think, and he was in the wholesale grocery business for a long time with his brothers and his father. That's where I was first introduced to distribution commerce. Yeah. My mother was a housewife,
yeah.
And she was doing what mothers did in the 50s.
Yes.
That's basically the story.
Well, I read that probably your first experience related to filmmaking, was it making something to sort of help at the grocery store or sort of instructive for other people?
Yes, well, because actually my father and both my uncles segued into the supermarket business, mm-hmm. and they began a small chain of supermarkets that were called Big Bear Markets in Detroit. And my dad was kind of the creative marketing guy, and my uncle was the tough business guy. But my dad was a wonderful father. And when I became interested in movies and photography and things like that, he was always eager to enlist me to use whatever talent I may or may not have had to make some extra money by doing work for the supermarket chain. And I had actually gone through a whole summer training program and circled through all the different departments of the supermarket business to get a kind of an early orientation when I was just, I think, 14 or 15, mm-hmm. about what the supermarket business was like. Obviously, my father had some point of view about making me do that. And one of the things that I did was I was a carryout boy at one of the supermarkets for a long time. I mean, for a couple of weeks during mm-hmm. that thing. So he felt that I had a understanding of what the carryout boys are supposed to do and not supposed to do. And I made a short film just about with a 16-millimeter Revere movie camera that I spliced together with a little actually, I think at that time was actually glue. You scraped off a little bit of the film, and there was just one copy because that was what came out of the camera. It didn't have sound. It had it was like a silent movie with title cards.
Right.
Anyhow, so yes.
And that was used for the other people learned from you there. It seems, though, that even though you went through this training program and whatever, it was important to your dad that you, it seems like law school was what he wanted for you. Maybe even if you weren't so sure you wanted it for yourself, right?
Yeah, well, my father was, as they said, he was a wonderful guy. And the thing that was particularly disturbing about him is he was so incredibly persuasive about the way he turned both of his children towards his point of view about a guy who was born in 1911 and as a young father, how he thought his children should learn and gain experience. And in both cases, my sister, who really did kind of have an interest in being in acting and things like that, and me, who also had an interest in being an actor, we both were cajoled in an extremely persuasive way, in my sister's case, to take a teaching certificate, because uh-huh. that's what young women did uh-huh. in Detroit anyhow, and get me to go to business school at the University of Michigan and then subsequently to law school, because we both had to have the equipment to make a living.
Right. And it was at Columbia that you first crossed paths with someone who I know would come back into your life years later. How did you and Michael Lynn first meet?
Michael and I went to Columbia at the same time, but he was in first section because of the alphabet A to wherever it was, yeah. and I was in the second section. So that there was never, we really never had any more, I think, extremely casual acquaintanceship. We weren't even friends or anything like that in law school. But subsequently, our daughters both went to a school in New York called Dalton mm-hmm. and were in the same class at a time right after I had started New Line and having severe problems trying to get financing and to explain to people what we were doing. Michael was suggested to me by my daughter that he was very effective in raising money, that his daughter had told my daughter that. So we ran into each other actually in Greenwich Village. Our two families were walking and on the opposite sides of the street, and we hailed one another. And I went over to Michael and reintroduced myself, sort of. And I had spoken to him at one point about trying to help me raise some money, but he was very noncommittal. But this particular episode, when we ran into each other again, he agreed that he would undertake the challenge, which yeah. it certainly was.
And let's go backwards, though, for a second before he re-entered the picture and just talk about you come out of Columbia, you graduate from Columbia, and it seems like between that and getting your Fulbright and going to Sweden, which I think was probably a better alternative than Vietnam, right? In between there, you did make your first actual film called Image, and I wonder if you can just share how that, what that was sort of roughly about and how it was received, because that's kind of a cool story.
Yeah, it was when I look back on it, I look back on it like what I guess Samuel Johnson said about the dancing dog. It wasn't so much that he danced well, but he danced at all. In some extent, the very fact that I did everything up to and including cutting the negative mm-hmm. Myself, when I think about it, how films are made now, I'm impressed, even though I'm impressed about myself. But what actually happened was I got involved making money in Detroit as a still photographer, and my folks, I think on my 13th birthday or 14th birthday, built a little dark room for me in their basement, and I would take pictures at dances and engagement parties, and was kind of like the boy photographer yeah. in the Upper West Side, Northwest Side in Detroit. I got a phone call from one of my best friends that I was going through high school with, and he said, well, you know, you're supposed to be the photographer in Detroit, but one of our classmates, a young lady named Sandra Rouche, she now had a boyfriend who won a prize that was called the Rosenthal Foundation Competition for the best short film by a filmmaker under the age of 25. Mm-hmm. And so, and he was teasing me like, you know, you're nothing now. Here's this guy. And Brian De Palma happened to be taking this girl out, and he won the prize. So I said, well, what the hell? I'm gonna handle this. Yeah. So I came up with this idea and spent a summer making the film. And the whole experience was quite scintillating for me. I made the film, went to a place called Movie Lab in New York, and got them to do some of the optical work. I had no clue what I was doing. I rented a camera and built my own dolly. I didn't even know what a dolly really was. And it was going to have a musical score. And I was introduced to a young musician named Walter Carlos, who had subsequently did Switched on Bach and the music for Clockwork Orange, I think. Mm-hmm. And we became quite good friends, and it's quite a long story. I won't bore your listeners with all the details. But the essential idea of the film was, it was at this time, there wasn't even called independent cinema. It was called underground movies, mm-hmm. and this kind of qualified for an underground movie. I put a "Would you like to be an actress?" sign on the bulletin board at Wayne State University in Detroit, which is a local university. And a very lovely young lady named Martine Allgaier answered, and she said, "Would you want to see my picture?" And she was quite beautiful. And I said, "There's going to be some nudity. It doesn't matter," because she was a real hippie. And so she became my star. And it's difficult to describe in a very kind of a simple way what the film is about, but it was only 12 minutes short, and it was about a question that we are now facing again, I suppose it's 50 years later. Mm-hmm. What we see on film, what's real? Is seeing really believing?
And how did it go over?
It went over actually pretty well, and as I said, I had another kind of crazy experience. I had to get it into the competition before I turned 25, and I was just 24 and 11 months, and I'm sitting in my, I actually stayed up like 72 hours at the end of the, just to be sure I got the thing in, because I had to get it notarized that I was under 25 and all the rest of the stuff. Anyhow, I submitted it, and I didn't hear, and I was living the summer in Manhattan. And one day I get a phone call, and I say, "Congratulations, you have won the Rosenthal Prize for the best film made by an American director under the age of 25. And I think it was $1,000 prize. And then I said, "Oh, my gosh, that's fantastic." And he said, "Yes, congratulations. But we do want to tell you that this year there was one other film that we really liked a lot, and so we've decided to split the prize this year." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "The other filmmaker, you may not know him because he went to NYU, but it's a guy named Martin Scorsese." And I said, "I didn't know him, but I'm glad to meet the guy." And
how was that?
Well, it was fine. I mean, I was in law school, so I was 3 or 4 years young.
Right.
But the guy, Richard Rosenthal, mm-hmm. who was chairman of Connecticut Light and Power, who put up the prize money, he had a big dinner party at his estate in Connecticut, and I was invited, and Marty was invited too, and that's where I met him for the first mm-hmm. time. And then that was just the beginning of
it. Yeah, no, that's great. And I think it may have been at about that time as well that you decided to just explore the possibility of going out to Hollywood, just to maybe you made some outreach about getting an internship or a job or something out there. Why did you not end up going out to LA and always remain basically a New York guy, maybe with an office in LA or something? But what happened that could have changed that?
Well, what actually happened was that the one film company that I felt a little bit akin to, because I was a underground filmmaker ostensibly, and my film, like Image, and another film that I made when I was in Sweden, was being distributed by the Filmmakers Co-op, Jonas Mekas's organization here in New York. I was scared to death of going out to Hollywood and meeting Sam Goldwyn and I mean, all these people. I mean, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know anybody out there. I didn't feel that my short had any kind of real currency in the commercial filmmaking. But the one company that I admired was called American International Pictures, and that was run by a guy named Sam Arkoff. I mean, what Sam Arkoff was doing was, I mean, he was hiring people like Jack Nicholson and,
right.
and one of his very strong collaborators and suppliers was...
Was it Roger Corman?
Roger Corman, yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah. It was Roger Corman. And these are the guys that I really, really admired. And yeah. they were the kind of films I wanted to make. And I was, they were scary or they were exciting or they were big comedies. And they had all young people in it. And so I sent Sam Arkoff a letter saying I was a graduate of Columbia Law School. And I was very anxious to be in the film business. And if he would please set up a meeting for me, I would come out to Los Angeles under my own aegis and work for him for nothing. I had saved up some money, which I had, and just to be an unpaid intern to him. And Sam Arkoff, who I subsequently did meet, was not particularly gracious in response to my note because he didn't answer it at all. And that's what started off my feeling of independence and just saying, I don't care. I know about the distribution business. Right. I know how to distribute coffee and sugar, so I might as well be able to distribute movies as well.
Well, I guess, though, the other key part before you could actually go about doing that was you were working, I know, in the stills department at MoMA, the film stills department. I think you were the film stills department, right? And the benefit of that was not only that you're dealing with film all day, but you're dealing, I guess, at certain nights and events with people in the film business. Is that how you became aware of the fact that there even was this college film circuit?
Absolutely. I think I'm very impressed with the depth of your research.
Thank
That's
you.
Very good.
Thank you.
When I got back from Sweden, I had made a documentary there called The Witch's Sabbath about a festival in Sweden that's called Walpurgisnacht, which essentially means the Witch's Sabbath, but is just kind of a college student free-for-all. But it has a lot of witchcraft history involved with it. And I tried to get those two films distributed. And as I said, I got turned down by virtually everybody who had a film distribution company. And there was one of the people that I called was Willard Van Dyke. Willard was his first name. Mm-hmm. And he was running the film department at MoMA, Museum of Modern Art. And so I called him up and I asked him if he had any people who were any producers or that I could maybe connect me with. And he said, no. He said, I showed him my two films, and they bought Image for their for the permanent library at MoMA. But he said, by the way, the only thing I can offer you in terms of a job is we need somebody to run the film stills department. Would you be interested? So it was a job. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, I did. So I was the film stills department. And they actually had been given a very large closet in the Metropolitan Life Insurance building across the street from MoMA. And I got installed in that large closet with a desk and a bunch of filing cabinets and was running the film stills department for what it was.
And it was in the course of other MoMA-related events that you start to realize maybe there's an opening for films for a college film circuit. I mean, it seems like the real... Correct me if this is wrong, but the real idea here of New Line in 67 was not that you were dying to be a film distributor. It was a means to get your own films out into the world, right?
Right. And it was also this feeling that I didn't have to be beholden to other people mm-hmm. to make it happen because it just was not my nature, frankly. So one of the provisos, because I wasn't getting paid very much for this job, was that I would be invited to all of the film events that the Museum of Modern Art Film Department would have. And so every time they had a display, an exhibition of something that had to do with film, there was always like an inaugural cocktail party. Mm-hmm. And I got to be invited to those cocktail parties. And at the same time, there was a program that was called New Films for the New Audience. Mm-hmm. No, it was called, this was Janus Films, mm-hmm. had put together a program. The film department at Lincoln Center showed the program at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
And they turned me down. They didn't want to take my films either. But I did get to go to one of the parties that they were having. And in this case, it was a party for the Czech film industry. Mm-hmm. And there was Closely Watched Trains, and I can't remember some of the other titles, but some really impressive Czech films. Mm-hmm. This is when art films were really in,
early
into
Miloš
their own,
early Forman
exactly.
and all that, yeah.
And so I, at that festival, I was still smarting from getting turned down by this fancy short film distributor that I guess that Janice Films was promoting. I met somebody who said, if I put together a program of films, they could distribute them on college campuses. So I said, I have a lot of friends who are making films, and I think I could put together a film program. But I had in the back of my mind, of course, to be distributing my own films, mm-hmm. too. And so I tried to figure out how I could compete with this program of short films that I believe it was Janice was distributing. And I decided to do something a little more elaborate. So my girlfriend at that time helped me to create a program notes, and I got a hold of four feature films, two Czech films, American film, and a documentary. And instead of just offering them like in a catalog the way college has typically got films, I created a whole program around them. So we had posters, program notes that we designed together. The posters were created, as it turned out, by some of the best poster artists in the United States. Seymour Schwast and Milton Glaser did several of our original posters. We created program notes, as I said, with background on who the directors were, and pictures and things like that. And they were called Seymour. We did trailers for the movie programs. And we made a whole big event out of it. And instead of just charging $200 to rent the films, we made a deal. We charged nothing, but it was 50-50. We got to split 50% with everybody, with all the different exhibitors. And that was how I launched New Line.
And so this is 1967. Can you just set the scene of where the company operated out of, how it looked in those early days? I mean, it was a pretty primitive setup, right?
It was pretty primitive. I was living with my Swedish girlfriend, who was gracious enough to come with me back to the United States after a little bit of travail. And we were living on 14th Street and 2nd Avenue. I was able to get the apartment because it was converted from a rent control apartment to a professional apartment. And I held myself out to be a filmmaker. I had actually declared some income from rental of my films, my tax return, so I was able to prove that I was making some sort of living as a filmmaker. And it was a 5-story walk-up, but it was just fine. And I bought a desk at a secondhand furniture company and started New Line.
Yeah.
That was it.
The motto from the beginning, I think, was new films for the new audience. And I know you guys, some of the early ones that really resonated with people were Sympathy for the Devil, for about the Rolling Stones, and then the re-release of Reefer Madness, which sort of fed into the midnight movie craze, all of this stuff. But can you just explain, because I think those maybe are examples of it, who was the new audience that you're talking about?
Well, the new audience was younger people, I felt, which is continuing. I mean, there's always been a struggle to get the younger crowd, and that was what I felt. I was the youngest guy in the business, besides the actors. Mm-hmm. And I was determined to come up with every marketing ploy I could figure out. So I was like, you know, trying to appeal to, we actually had at one point, I think on our letterhead, nobody in this company is over the age of 30 until I got to be 30. But we had those first 3 years. And it was just doing whatever we could to, given the programming material that I was able to offer, to make it seem sexy and fun. I mean, one of the programs of the American film that was made was called The Virgin President. And it actually had a lot of people from Chicago's Second City. Severin Darden, particularly, who was a real classic comedian, was in the movie. And that was, we were doing something different. This was sort of hip.
Yeah. And with Sympathy for the Devil, it's the counterculture sort of music and politics. With Reefer Madness, it's the drug sort of laughing at the cautionary stuff. Then you've got a bunch of variety, which was always what defined, I guess, New Line for its entire existence. Because just to give some of these from these early 70s examples, sort of artsy films like maybe or foreign, like the Werner Herzog ones you guys were doing. You've got comedies, John Waters starting as early as Pink Flamingos in 72, I think after you had learned about him with One You Turned Down. And then martial arts was something that I believe became a fixation of yours after going to Cannes and seeing something you could not buy there. So that's where the whole Sonny Chiba thing comes about. I think the thing this is all to ask you about is that the difference between you and the big studios out in LA seems like they had to make movies that would appeal to everyone because they're putting a lot of money into them. For you, the idea was that you can target niche audiences and do just fine that way?
Yes, of course. But we weren't making movies. I just had to find movies.
Yeah.
And there was a guy here in New York who was a very classy art film distributor named Don Rugoff, who started a company called Cinema 5, and he had an incredible advantage, which is he had the best art theaters in the city, besides Dan Talbot, who was running the New Yorker Cinema. Don Rugoff, who was a curmudgeon as far as I was concerned, he had money. They went public, and there was not a great film that I wanted to get that he didn't snap up and grab away from me. So I really had to look under. I've read Variety from, the Weekly Variety, because mm-hmm. that's what we got mm-hmm. in New York, cover to cover, mm-hmm. looking for stuff. And that, for instance, is how I found Sympathy for the Devil. There was a little 3 or 4 line squib in somewhere on page 32 about a film that they had made called Sympathy for the Devil. And because we were sort of like trying to be classy at the same time, it was directed by Jean-Luc Godard. I said, well, this is perfect. And they wanted $50,000 as a minimum guarantee, and they showed the film to everybody before. I kept sending them letters and stuff. This is the English producer, and they finally said, okay, you can screen the film in New York if you want. And we screened the film, and it was Godard at his nadir. it was severe left-wing political tract, but it did have the Rolling Stones recording Sympathy for the Devil. And I turned to a colleague of mine who was our best salesman selling films, getting the films booked in colleges, a guy who I'm actually working with today, named Seth Willenson. And I said, this is a piece of junk. We can't show this. We can't offer this. He said, are you out of your mind? He said, do these people, the older jerks that are out there that are running distribution companies, this film has the Rolling Stones in it. These older people, they don't even know what Rolling Stones. You gotta go out and get this film. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have $50,000, but I sent them a note, and which is how I really got all of the films mm-hmm. at the beginning. And I said, listen, I think I can get you at least $50,000 within 9 months. And I'll split with you on a 50-50 basis. I think a 60-40 basis. Mm-hmm. You guys take 60, we'll take 40. And let us have the film. If at the end of 9 months you haven't received at least $50,000, and that's only non-theatrically, we won't show it theatrically at all. It's all going to be in schools and art institutes and things like that we're going to show it. But I'm confident that we can get you $50,000. And of course, we did, and mm-hmm. People did not like the film particularly, but they certainly went to see it.
Yeah,
that was my first beginning to really appreciate what you did.
So the company's evolution, if we can talk about just 1977, you guys get into production with stunts. 1978, you win an Oscar for the first time with Get Out Your Handkerchiefs, a French film with Gerard Depardieu. And 1984, it seems like, was the real, now we're on the map with Nightmare on Elm Street. And I wonder if you can just share this on paper. It couldn't at the time have sounded like a movie that would come to be so associated with you guys that you guys were sometimes called the house that Freddie built, I think. How did that happen? Why did Nightmare on Elm Street, just after Michael Lynn and you had reconnected and he comes, I think, to work here, or maybe right...
No, he was just... That was afterwards, Michael Lynn. And he didn't come to work here at all. He came... He was
as
outside.
Counsel,
he
right.
was a very successful boutique lawyer
right.
who was representing some very high-quality young artists, Yul Brynner and his, mm-hmm. and actors. So he was really on top of his game. I mean, I was just a little punk, even though we went to the same school together. But so he tried to raise some money for me. It didn't work. And then when we had this encounter in Greenwich Village a few years later, and I was desperate for somebody, he said, okay, I will do this, but I will only do it if you give me, at my firm, I don't do things without a retainer. So you have to give me a $10,000 retainer. Well, we had $17,000 in our bank account, and I didn't really know. I had to go back and really think about this myself. We had a small group, but we still had salaries to pay and rent. We moved out of my apartment on 5th floor on 2nd Avenue and moved into a loft on University Place, and I had overhead, it minor, but it was there. But I just decided that I really needed a high-quality lawyer to do this because I had no clue.
It was mainly to help you raise money?
Oh, yeah. That was how it started off, mainly to raise money. So even though I only had $17,000, I wrote out a check for $10,000, and I sent it by messenger to him that day to make show that I was a big shot. And so that's how Michael came to...
And what about Nightmare...
Well, Nightmare on Elm Street, but there was here again. I was struggling. I tried to get the Monty Python and the Holy Grail movie, and Don Rugoff snapped it away from me. Michael White was one of the producers, and I did everything I could possibly think of doing to get those guys to make a deal with me. I was going to borrow some money. I didn't know, and of course Don Rugoff just walked in and disappeared. So one of the producers of that movie, a guy named Mark Forstatter, became friendly, and he said, you know, your problem is you just don't have any product. I said, I know, but I don't know how to get it. I knew some underground filmmakers, and I go to the Czech Film Festival, but that's I need to do more than that. I'm getting nowhere. And he said, well, why don't you get on an airplane and go to Los Angeles, and I'll go with you, and we'll try to find some product together. So I went with Mark to Los Angeles, and he introduced me to Toby Hooper, the guy who did Gremlins. The third one was Wes Craven.
Uh-huh.
And I, just as kind of a meet and greet
yeah.
kind of thing. And Wes Craven wouldn't meet me, but I had a telephone conversation with him, and I said, well, what do you have that's new that maybe we can raise some money and make things happen? He said, well, I've got this story about of nightmares, and you know how everybody has nightmares, but how they're so relieved to wake up from them. And this is a nightmare that you can't wake up from because there's a boogeyman, and all these kids are dreaming about this same guy. And I said, well, send me the script. He said, well, there's some other people, and I'll think about it. So for 6 months, I was calling the guy every couple of weeks. Sending him notes. I almost lost my pride after this. But I thought it was such a brilliant idea. And it was something that was so easy to sell because everybody completely knew what the scary part was. And so that was the inception. With $5,000 at that point to option the script to begin developing the movie.
And the movie in the end, if this is correct, you guys must have raised, and it cost $2 million and made 25. Does that sound right?
No, it cost, it was supposed to cost $600,000, and it ended up costing $1.25 million. And I can tell you, it's another story, but the anguish that I went through and the guys that lied to me, betrayed me, that we're going to invest, we're not going to invest, let's see, what are you going to do? And I ended up getting together the $600,000 through a guy named Joe Wolf, who was head of a company called Media Home Entertainment. And the only reason that I was able to get that money together was because home video was such an incredible gold mine for movie production.
Just coming on the scene,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the other key thing, just quickly about that, was that had you not fought a little bit to change the ending, there would not have been a franchise of sequels, right?
Well, that's also a long story, but the truth is that Wes, it was an extremely passive-aggressive guy, and I wear almost all my feelings on my sleeve. We had a peculiar relationship, but it worked. And we were shooting it in Los Angeles. We rented an office at Desilu Studios. And the only really one big fight that we ever had was about the ending. We weren't throwing ashtrays and cursing one another. But he said the original ending for Nightmare on Elm Street was arguably correct. His ending was that after Nancy vanquishes Freddy and they go run through the house and do all the stuff, the next morning when she wakes up, her mother says, "Have a nice day at school." She opens the door, walks out, and walks down the street, and that's the end of the movie. And there has always been a convention in scary movies that you got that one last scare that you thought you finally we got past all of the bad stuff, and then mm-hmm. something really terrific happens that scares the hell out of you. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that you want. One thing every filmmaker who particularly is making entertainment movies wants is he wants people to talk about the film when they're walking out of the theater, and just to say, "Well, there she is. She won. That's great. Great for her." Was just not it, and so I didn't really know what it should be, but I didn't want to. I didn't think we were going to have a film that was going to end on the right kind of note, and Wes was really insistent that that's how what he wanted to do it. So we ended up shooting three different endings. And because he was just ready to throw up his hands. This was just... Well, the movie was over. It was the last thing. Right. And we could not figure out how to end the movie. So we shot three endings. It turned out that after screening the film for different people, having little friends and family screenings here in New York, we just couldn't figure out how to end it. So Wes finally gave up. We said, let's use all of them, which I thought was really kind of ridiculous. But it turned out that worked out, too. So
and it left open the possibility of having...
Yes, I did not... It wasn't for me so much about expecting to do a sequel. Yeah. I hadn't even... If sequels... I mean, of course, it had been happening from time immemorial with movies, but it wasn't really my primary intent. What I was really hoping to do was just to have a movie that really worked, and if it really worked, then maybe we could do something else. I suppose in the back of my head there was but it wasn't planned
right.
as to be.
Because who could have imagined it would go over that well, even at that point?
I had no idea, and I will tell you that one of the great thrills for an independent filmmaker, and probably for every filmmaker that's ever existed, except a few that are the Europeans who didn't care, is when you go to see the opening night and there's lines around the block. We went down to Broadway and I forget who I was with. I suppose I was with my wife too. And she, "Bobby, there's lines around the block." I said, "What? I can't believe that there's lines around the block." And sure enough, and boy, that is really so exciting. And it's suggested correctly that we'd finally hit it.
Yeah.
Finally hit it.
To the extent that just 2 years later, you guys became a publicly traded company, and just 4 years after that, I guess you're looking for, to staff up a little bit more and looking maybe, it sounds like, for a number two person, and that is where you decided to sort of formalize things with Michael?
Yes, what happened was that, we finally put together a distribution company that had the right kind of personnel with it. It was still small. Nobody ever heard of us, but we had the Nightmare on Elm Street as our first film, and then we made Critters, which we managed to get away from Roger Corman, and that worked out really well. And it was at that time that there was everybody was making money in the stock market. Everybody was. And so the investment bankers were looking for, just needed to have a warm body to to do a prospectus for. And we actually got offered, and Mike Milken was there with the junk bonds. Mm-hmm. And everybody was offering us junk bonds. It was like, as I said, three or four different big investment bankers were offering us a chance to do an underwriting. And Michael was our outside lawyer. And
Michael Lynn,
yeah. Turned out that of all the companies that were offering us money, they all were offering us junk bonds. And so you'd raise a little bit of money as equity, but really borrow a bunch of money. And the thing about junk bonds is that they're usually issued by unreliable issuers like New Line Cinema, but people would invest in them because they paid an inordinate amount of interest. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like 14% or something like that. So of all of the companies that talked to us, the only one that came up with sage advice was, ironically, Drexel Burnham. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't Mike Milken, but it was one of his managing directors. And he said, listen, I can raise for you $50 million if you want, or $25 million or whatever it was. And you have to sell 50% of your company on the stock market. But I promise you, we will get you this money. But I want to know, you have to tell me, what are you going to do with it? Are you just going to put it in the bank? Because if you do, you're making a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. That you're going to be paying 14% a year interest. And unless you have a certainty that you're going to be getting income coming out, if you're talking about just making movies and borrowing 14% a year to make the movie, you're going to lose your company besides, mm-hmm. because you'll have sold 50% and it'll be nowhere. Mm-hmm. So I took another risk, like the risk of staying in New York and not going to Los Angeles, and I said, I think you're right. And so instead of raising $50 million that I forget who it was, but there were companies that aren't around anymore, actually. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But they were big investment bankers, and but instead of selling 50%, I sold only 15% of the company on the stock market. We only raised, I think, like $8 million or something like that, and we did not have any junk bonds at all. But that was the sort of beginning of a structure, a financial structure, that made some sense for what our business was. And we were very fortunate, also with attracting a very talented bunch of people my age and younger, mostly younger, up to and including Mike DeLuca, who got started when he was 19 years old. I think I was only 28 or something like that, 29. And coming up with ideas that were really viable and continuing to cater to a younger audience and to a niche audience, which is what we were.
Well, what did it mean? The company motto was prudent aggression, I should say. Is that the same thing as rather than spend a fortune and try to be like one of these big studios, let's focus on things? Like, you guys were doing urban films targeting a black audience before anyone else really was doing that.
House Party
1990, Menace to Society 1993, Set It Off 1996,
right.
And cornering that market, that niche of the market.
Well, I mean, Sam Arkoff did some of those, and there were blaxploitation movies, mm-hmm. that were around, but they were a different kind of movie, really. Mm-hmm. They weren't really for a younger audience. They weren't like, Salt and Pepper, for instance, who were the stars of the House Party series. Fruit and Aggression came about because we were constantly trying to raise money. Even though we had an investment banker, we had Drexel Burnham as our investment banker. We ended up switching because Michael's best friend in college was a guy named Roy Furman, and he started a firm with some other partners called Furman Seltz, and they took over our financing activities, basically. And so I found myself talking to banks and talking to doing road shows during our different kinds of equity and eventually debt offerings. And I'd get questions. Well, what's the difference about you guys? Why are you, what's special about you? Why do I want to invest in a movie company? And so I made up this thing. I said well, we can't go after everything, but when we find something that we really like, we just really go crazy to get it. It's just that we don't have enough money to go crazy after all the good stuff. We have to pick and choose. And so I just coined that idea of prudent aggression, and it actually was the cover of our first annual report.
And so maybe then, now that I understand more what it means, I guess the key early example of that, of going after hard something that maybe others aren't seeing the potential in, would that have been a movie that was a big part of my childhood, 1990s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? I mean, that's a movie that other people walked away from, right?
Oh, that is a very nice story. That happened because I had never heard of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This guy, Raymond Chow, who kind of betrayed a deal that we had made for the best kung fu artist of all time. We lost that movie. Big Boss, there were two, Big Boss and Fist of Fury that I'd seen with Werner in Cannes, and Raymond Chow represented him. It was Bruce Lee. And even though we had a deal, he took it away from us because he wanted $50,000 and I didn't have $50,000. Again, that boogie man of $50,000. So Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, we heard about it and it was around. I had no clue what it was, and And both our head of sales, who was a guy named Mitch Goldman, and our head of production for what it was Sarah Risher, they both had young kids. I didn't have children yet, and they both came into my office. They said, "You know that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is a movie that's coming out. It had been on television for a long time, but it was the toys and all the stuff." And they both came into my office they obviously talked about it before and said, "We got to go after this movie." And we had some money at this point. And so we called up the guy who was the sales agent for Raymond Chow, a guy named Tom Gray, got him to come in. And again, we were the last store on the block. And everybody had said, "No, are you crazy? Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? What the hell is that?" And I said to these people, this Sarah and Mitch, "Are you sure that this is really something? Because these guys, they want $5 million as a minimum guarantee to distribute the movie." They said, "I'm telling you." And Mitch Goldman said, "I'm going to take this letter opener. I'm going to slash my hand and sign that I will pay you back every dime if you don't." So anyhow, we went after. We got it for, I think, $3 million. And that
opened
was the first
at number one.
It was the first time this ever happened. I called up Mitch Goldman that night, the Friday evening that it opened, and I said, "How will we do?" He said, "You can't believe it. I think we're going to end up doing $10 million box office." I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, I think we're going to do $10 million tonight." And that was like, it was a whole new ball game.
So your first New Line film to open at number one at the box office, I think in the end, $130 million, making it the highest grossing indie film up to that point.
At that time, yeah.
And I think it's interesting that throughout all this, you're balancing these sort of such a variety of stuff, because there's the Fine Line movies that came along also in 1990, Fine Line, where you are sort of having your art house division, I think, because of the success of Metropolitan.
What was happening was that the Weinsteins were kind of grabbing the art films. And I felt like we shouldn't, that was part of our bread and butter, and we shouldn't have just forgotten them. I mean, I liked those films in many cases more than some of the commercial stuff we were making. And we had actually had a deal, I thought, that was put together by Weinstein's lawyer, who happened to also be a Columbia Law graduate in my class and was a good friend of both Michael's and mine, to possibly take over the distribution of Weinstein's business. They were going to be more producing.
Wow.
And Weinstein, we set up a meeting in Cannes to meet to discuss it. Michael and I and the lawyer, Ben Zinkin, all went over to see Weinstein. He didn't show up. And again, I said, "What the hell is that all about?"
Yeah.
You tell him to take his movies and screw him.
Yeah, right.
And so we said, let's make a different division. We can't mix up all this stuff. And that's where Fine Line came.
And that was initially Ira Deutschman.
Ira Deutschman.
Right. And I just want to mention for the listeners, because it is pretty unbelievable, the quality movies that you guys put out through that. My Own Private Idaho, 1991. The Player, 1992. Shortcuts, 1993. Naked, 1993. Hoop Dreams, 1994. Shine, 1996, which was your big sort of Oscar movie of that era.
Right.
The Sweet Hereafter, 1997. Dancer in the Dark, 2000. Maria Full of Grace, 2004. We can go on and on and on. But I guess it's interesting because for a while, what the Weinsteins would say was that their art house movies were sort of made financially possible by what they started to probably compete with you guys, to try to compete with you guys, which was the Dimension side of their business, right? Where Bob's trying to do horror movies and Scream and whatever. You guys, meanwhile, on the commercial side, where it suddenly, for a period there, it was the Jim Carrey business, right?
Yeah, well, that's a little bit later on in the game, but that's also that was when things really started getting exciting. And that, and the Mask was still one of my all-time favorite movies. And at that time, you know, Jim was had just done one movie, which was Ace Ventura, and it was really Chuck Russell who directed the Mask, who suggested Jim because of his television show.
In Living Color.
Yeah, exactly.
And also Cameron Diaz had never really been in anything.
No. But that, again, was Chuck Russell. Chuck found her. I wanted to have Anna Nicole.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I thought it was, you know, va-va-voom.
Yeah,
something out of, it was like Mad Comics.
Right,
that's what
right.
I thought the sort of thing was. It actually did come from Dark Horse Comics, you may know. That is the story for the Mask.
Yeah.
But Chuck said no. I think Cameron Diaz is be perfect, and I one of the very rare times that I was acting like a mogul. I said, well, we have to. I think they want a va 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 boom girl. So could we figure out some way to make her, or, you know, boost her up a little bit, and so they said, oh, okay, well, we'll try to boost her a little bit. So, she was just so adorable and was so perfect for the role.
And that was earlier in '94 that the Mask comes out. Then later in '94, you guys did Dumb and Dumber, and I want to read back to you a quote from DeLuca that I think I want to get your reaction to. He says, quote, I was at a premiere one night when Jim Carrey needed an instant answer to whether we'd pay him $7 million to do Dumb and Dumber. And I asked Bob right in the middle of the party, and he said, let's do it, close quote. This is a guy who you had paid $450,000 to do The Mask just months earlier, and on the spot you were in for $7 million. That, at the time, I think, was an unprecedented amount.
The story is actually a little bit more colorful than
yeah.
that. Because we had a two-picture deal with Jim Carrey, and this is Hollywood versus the Independent.
Right.
And I think we paid him $700,000 for the Mask, and I think the second picture was going to be $1.5 million or something. And his agents started being wise guys. And so we had decided to do a public relations ploy, and instead of sending we'd heard grumblings about that it wasn't going to be as easy to get them to do this as just because it says just because we had a contract.
Right.
So we took an ad in Variety and we exercised our option for the second picture. We sent the letter that we had sent to exercise our option as a full page ad in Variety, and it's coming Jim Carrey in our next. And the agents called up and said, screw you. You think he's going to do this? He says, he's not doing it for this amount of money or anything else. And don't even think about it. And that's no way to exercise an option. It's take an ad in the newspaper. Well, then Dumb and Dumber had been submitted to us by four different producers. And we actually had the option on it twice. And DeLuca hated it. He despised it. He couldn't believe how. And the last time it came in, he said, "Never ever get me this. I don't want. I'm not having to have anything to do with this movie." But we had a deal with National Lampoon, and I thought even if the script was less than perfect by a very huge margin. But the title, National Lampoon's Dumb and Dumber, we got to be able to do something with it. And then I saw the director's cut of The Mask. I said, this is perfect. And I can't remember the name of the guy, the producer. He called me up and he said, I bought the option for Dumb and Dumber. I said, we don't want it. We don't want it. DeLuca won't take it. I don't want it. He said, listen, not only do we have the option, but Jim Carrey wants to do the movie. And that was the whole background on how this all came. I said, listen, man, if Jim Carrey wants to do this movie, I've just seen The Mask, and it is an unbelievable dynamite movie. I don't care, you know, it's that old expression, if you're, this guy could read the phone book and people would come. That was really how I felt about Jim Carrey. If he read the phone book, it was going to be great. So, and this was not the phone book, but it had its problems, there's no question about it. And so that all came about when they said, well, what does Jim Carrey want for it? You see, his agents now want $7 million. Said, well, we have an option. He said, yeah, we'll forget that. And we were at a screening at the Directors Guild. And he, DeLuca and Mike, Richard Saverstein were there. And they both said, listen, you got to make a decision. Are we going to spend $7 million to get Jim Carrey, even though we have an option? I mean, you want a lawsuit or do you want to make a movie? And he said, you got to make a decision right now. And we actually walked into it. There was a phone booth right there in the lobby. And we called up the agent. And I said, okay, $7 million, you got a deal? He said, yes, you got a deal. And that was it.
Amazing. Well, I want to just note that you guys were early bettors on a lot of auteurs. Fincher with Seven, Paul Thomas Anderson with Boogie Nights, Gary Ross with Pleasantville, on, and some of their second movies too, Magnolia for Paul Thomas Anderson. The comedies, I know, started to become very successful betting on people that were not, you know, sort of SNL cast-offs, whether it was Mike Myers with Austin Powers or Adam Sandler with Wedding Singer. But the really interesting thing that I wanted to bring up is that with action movies, Rumble in the Bronx with Jackie Chan, Money Talks with Chris Tucker, and then this idea, who comes up with the idea to put those two guys together for Rush Hour, which I think was your biggest movie to date financially when it came out?
Well, I have to say their big vote of confidence, vote of appreciation, is it's not like I never thought I was going to do it all. I had other ideas. I really wanted to be a director, the truth be told. But I was doing this because of this independence. That's really what I believed in. But the other thing I believe in a lot is that if you're going to work with people, they should feel like they're your partners and not be an ashtray thrower. So we actually had a fantastic development and a team of people who really had the zeitgeist of their generation incredibly clear in their minds. And even though they may or may not have had other issues, I could get around the issues because it didn't really matter to me. I wanted people to say or to feel when they got up in the morning, I can't wait to get to work. Nobody's going to scream at me. It's going to be a really collegial organization. And if there was any time that I really ever got mad at employees, which was very rare, it was only because the collegiality had been undermined by a boss or something like that. And so, and just to note, that includes Mike DeLuca, Toby Emmerich, Donna Langley, Mary Parent, Paul Bruchek. I mean,
Farm system of people that went on to run.
Well, yeah, but so did, you know, I mean, Roger Corman did that, and Sam Arkoff did that. So in a way, I suppose I learned from what they did. Mm-hmm. That don't let Warner Brothers or Columbia Pictures or 20th Century Fox tell you what to do. And as I've often said, one of the things that nobody has a monopoly on creativity.
Right.
And that's really the exciting thing about being in the movie business altogether. Anybody can do it. You just have to have guts and be right. I'm going to back up for a second because you're asking me who came up with the idea for Jackie Chan. With Rush Hour, there was a producer named Arthur Sarkisian. And Arthur Sarkisian had the rights to Rush Hour for some reason. Arthur Sarkisian had betrayed a business arrangement that we had. He gave a film that he controlled over to somebody else, and he said, the next film, and we got really mad at him because he said, the next film I get is going to be Rush Hour, and I'm going to let you guys have a shot at it. And so that's how it came together.
So it's the 1990s, and you guys are booming, and how do you even wind up talking to Ted Turner?
I had seen Ted Turner at something that was in New York that Drexel Burnham used to put on called the Predator's Balls. And they were these huge things with all of the companies that had sold junk bonds and all this. It would come together for... And one of the speakers at one of these... And I was a little jerk. I was just a little company. We didn't even sell any junk bonds. But because of the one guy who was on our board, who was a Drexel Burnham manager, he included me. It was part of, come along. But I was really kind of a mascot. I mean, I didn't know who these guys were. I didn't know Donald Trump or any of these people. They were all running around raising hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. But when I saw Ted Turner, he was give his speech, and also I knew about some of his interest in movies. First of all, I was a bit drunk, I think, when he gave the speech, but he was so funny and so charming that I asked somebody if they could possibly introduce me to him. And the guy who I asked, who was a filmmaker as well, said he would, but he really didn't do anything, forgot it. One day, these guys from Roy Furman's company, Furman and Sells, said, would you like to meet Ted Turner? This is after they became to represent us. And I said, yeah, I've been trying to meet the guy for a year and a half. And can you work it out? He said, yes, well, he said that he would like to meet you. I said, fantastic. So Michael Lynn and I and this guy, whose name is Michael Guerin, who worked for Roy Furman, get on a commercial plane and fly to Atlanta to meet Ted Turner. And we go in to meet the guy. And he was really in his prime, too. I mean, we went into his office. It was papered with magazine covers of him winning the America's Cup and this and that. And he was just so oozing incredible enthusiasm and charm. So we're sitting down with him and a couple of his financial people, and Michael and I and this guy, Michael Guerin. And they're talking, and I'm talking, and I'm wildly excited to meet this guy. And after about 15 minutes, Ted says, well, let's do it. And I said, what do you mean, let's do it? He said, well, come on, let's just make the deal. I said, well, excuse me, could I just talk to my colleagues? So we get up, and we go outside, and I said, what the bloody hell is he talking about? Let's do it. He said, well, he came here to talk. I said, I came here to meet the guy. I didn't know it was an audition or something. I said, what do you think? He said, well, it's up to you, but I was the largest shareholder in the company. He said, let's, and I had no thought at all about selling a New Line. I mean, that was not what we had a company. It was great. I mean, we're going to, make movies, and it's going to be big. And what do I want to sell the Ted Turner for? And so I said, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And he said, well, it's up to you. You guys, So we buffed and said, Ted, I appreciate your welcome and everything, and I'd like the conversation. Let me think about it. So I came back to Los Angeles with everybody. Michael said, listen, I said, what do you think we should do? He said, I don't even want to tell you what I think you should do. I think you should think about it. It's your company effectively. And you just decide. You just think. So I spent the weekend thinking about it. And I came to the conclusion that if I was running a company, that there was no way that I could take this little independent company and turn it into something really big time unless we really had a really major backing behind us. And I was getting older, and I've been doing this for 10, 15 years by that point, I guess, and maybe it was more.
Even more, yeah. It's the 90s, so 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years. Yeah. And it's, you know, most of my time was wasted trying to raise money. Mm. And it was just a constant thing. I had, you know, coming up with ideas, prudent and aggression, this and that. What's special about you guys? How are you going to get the big stars? What are you going to do? I said to myself that I don't think that I can make this into a billion-dollar company in the next 5 years, because I don't exactly know how to do it, and there was a lot of independent companies that started up, went public, raised big money, and lost it all. And there was always that thing about you. And I, of all of the people, the titans, Ted was the only guy that really amused me, mm-hmm. and that I really thought he had independent spirit. And he liked three things: he liked movies, he liked news, and he liked sports. And that was it. And he had flirted with other movie companies, and they'd been sold, and we were the kind of, I suppose, the last guy on his list. But then, so it was like with Raymond Chow, mm-hmm. or any of these, or with Wes Craven, mm-hmm. we weren't the first person you thought about. So I said, okay, let me spend a little more time with Ted. So I said, let's pursue an arrangement. And the thing that really got me on his side completely was I was making lunch for him at our house one day, and we were talking about stuff. And I said, listen, Ted, the truth of the matter, I was making lists of things I had to talk to him about. And I said, the truth is, though, that I just want to know what would happen. I mean, we've been making movies for $10, $15, maybe $20 million, but we may want to make a $35 million movie, for instance. Is there going to be any kind of restrictions? He said, listen, Bob, I don't care if you make an $80 million movie. Just make one that's going to make money for me. I want a team that is always swinging for the bleachers. You get me some home runs, I'm going to finance it, and it's going to be a wonderful partnership. And but the side story to that is we ended up shaking hands and making the whole deal happen, and Ted was a real prince about it. But the first thing that he did, he said, I want you to come out to my ranch in Montana, and my new wife, Jane Fonda, is going to be there, and you and Michael come out, and we're going to be partners together. So I said, okay, that sounds fantastic. So we all flew out to Montana to spend a long weekend with Ted and Jane. But he was a madman about stuff. I mean, they came and woke us up at 6 o'clock in the morning with coffee, he and Jane, I mean, Jane Fonda knocking on your door. And it would be like breakfast at 7, Bob. You know, is an hour enough for you to get dressed? I'm sure it is. So, okay, yeah, sure, I'll be there. So yeah, we have breakfast at 7 to 8. Then we'd go skeet shooting on his property for an hour and a half. Then we'd go out and shooting quail, riding on Tennessee Walker horses with hunting dogs and stuff. Then we'd be at lunch, and then... I mean, I was completely whacked out by that time. He said, if we go fishing, and he'd go and get in these electric boats and go big mouth bass fishing on his property. So this first weekend, he and I were just walking together, and I was really waxing poetic. I said, among other things, I said, Ted, you know, this is really good. I really feel like the partnership is going to really last, and I really feel you're really making me feel like I'm a real partner. I mean, I just don't even, you know, think that I sold you anything. I just feel like I'm your partner. He stopped me, turned me around, looked at me and said, Bob, we are partners, but don't kid yourself. You definitely sold me the company.
And it seems like the upside was that you did have the ability to make bigger movies than you, or bigger budgeted movies, but the
The first movie we made after that with his money was Long Kiss Goodnight. And it was a $4.5 million script.
Yeah.
We made three house parties for $4.5 million. And it was just the script was $4.5 million. And on top of that, Jane hated it, and he didn't like it too well himself. But he was such a, you know, a stand-up guy about this stuff. But yeah, then we started really going.
Obviously, at that time, you couldn't have imagined that there's going to come a point where he's going to sell to AOL, Time Warner, right?
I was there. It all happened. He met Steve Case. The whole senior management of Time Warner, which was taken on a trip to China for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it culminated with the Fortune magazine having this big conference in Beijing, with worldwide business or something. I mean, we just were part of the team.
Yeah.
And that's where he met Steve Case. And that was incredible. I mean, Ted... That was when Jerry Levin was in the picture, because Ted had sold his company to Jerry Levin.
Right. So, when you first learned that AOL had acquired Time Warner, which you were now under at that point, it seemed, I've read that it was initially, this is great news, right? Like, this is, I guess, for stock reasons and various other things, initially it was a good thing.
Well, at that point, I mean, the wonderful thing about this timeline is that nobody ever bothered us.
Right.
And nobody understood us. And when Ted sold to Time Warner, the first thing Levin wanted to do was to spin off New Line, which would have made perfect sense. I mean, they needed us like I needed a hole in the head.
Because
they already had Warner Brothers.
Right. Why are they going to need two? And you guys, the feeling was... No hard feelings. Let's separate. It doesn't make sense.
It did not make sense. They hated us. The Warner Brothers guys. It wasn't really a friendly. It wasn't, you know, aggressive. But they had better deals. They had better international deals. They had better television deals. They had better home video deals. They had better everything. But the reason that we were still there is because of Ted. And Ted said, "You guys are my bench strength." And I think he was a little worried about what might happen with that Hollywood was possibly going to be a challenge.
But part of it was also that they had TBS and all these cable channels that needed content, right? So I guess for a while that's how they justified having both places, right? Both Warner Brothers and you guys.
The first thing they wanted us to sell the New Line. We did a roadshow with Roy Furman, running around all over Europe trying to get people. But Ted insisted that if they would, he would not sell New Line unless he got at least $3 billion for it,
which was never going to happen.
It was not going to happen.
So he was just.
And after that, you know, I think that Jerry and I mean, they knew that Ted was a bit of a maverick, and they made him vice chairman of the company, but they were not interested in his way of doing business. And you know, I think that it was never discussed with me, but it seemed like there was some skepticism about, you know, where he was going to fit into the overall organization anyhow. So they just kind of left us there. And so what happened was, though, that we requested a budget at the beginning of every year, and at the end of the year, there would be a budget meeting. We'd outline what our films had done for the previous year. We made money for the company every year, with the exception of one, which was the year that we did Little Nicky.
2000.
And that was a whole other story. Yeah. But we ended up just making money for them, and we didn't say we want to have a, you know, $10 billion, except we did once. but they said fine. Then Jeff Fuchs and I were on very good terms. Michael, everybody loved Michael. It was a perfect combination. He was the sanguine. voice of reason, and I was the guy, you know, with hair all over the place and making a lot of noise and stuff, which wasn't really true. Right. It was a little bit of an act that we both were playing.
Right. Good cop, bad cop.
It was totally like that, yes. I mean,
but it's kind of amazing that you're in this new corporate situation, and it's at that moment that you guys say, we're going to bite off probably the biggest thing that you'd ever, I mean, how could it not be the biggest thing by far that you'd ever bitten off with Lord of the Rings?
No question about it, but it's the first time I ever ran into something that had the same inchoate excitement that A Nightmare on Elm Street did. It took me 40 years.
Wow.
Almost, well, there were some great movies along the way. Yeah. But that was the one that I said, everybody knows this series of books. The Weinsteins bought them. I have one of my many twangs of regret and jealousy. Yeah, I did. I really thought, you know, that was a great idea.
Well, because the property had obviously been around forever, right? Saul Zantz to the Weinsteins to everything. But just, I know this is probably the story you're most sick of telling, but I think it's essential to the plot here.
Well, I think it's I'm glad to tell it one more time because I just want to get it right.
Yeah.
Right. Tom Freston told me at one point that he was talking to some other people after we had made the deal for the films, and they were saying, oh, that Bob Shea is such an a-hole. He doesn't know what he's doing. And yeah, I can imagine he's going to sink the whole goddamn place. It was not possible that was going to happen. We could have had serious financial repercussions. But when I told Rolf Mittwig, who was head of our international company, and that our whole business philosophy just, it wasn't like sat down and worked out, but that was how we got financing. We couldn't get it from on a timely way from the typical sources. So what we financed our productions through pre-sales
of international,
just foreign. We almost never took on a movie unless international said yes, it's okay. And I will tell you, Rolf Mittwig a couple of times said, I don't want it. So take it somewhere else. I'm not. And I said, well, if you're working for me, you can't say that. We actually got along quite well. But the point was that he went out and checked before anything was signed. And these guys were going. We had the biggest local companies like New Line in every major territory in the world, who were not only going to take one movie, they had to take three movies, and they were paying the biggest guarantees they had ever paid before to get this film.
Well, let's step back for just a second, though, because I think this is the ultimate middle finger to Harvey Weinstein, which must have felt good, that he's not able to get Peter Jackson to... He's insisting, right, one movie and a limited budget, and Peter Jackson... How does Peter Jackson, then, when it's a Weinstein movie, end up in your office?
I have no tears for Harvey Weinstein, but I can tell you that he thought that he had really aced out when he sold his company to Disney. And if you read some of the other articles about what happened there, I think that Mike Eisner did not trust him. And that when Harvey Weinstein said, I'm going to make two movies and they're each going to be $75 million each, I think Eisner said, you make one movie for $85 million, and that's just it. Nobody ever told me this, and it's just a little bit that I've surmised and from where I've read. And I think Harvey went to Peter Jackson and said, I'm going to make one movie for... And Jackson went ballistic, and in that sort of passive-aggressive way that New Zealanders know how to do. And Harvey was forced into saying, I'll give you 1 week to get somebody else who will put up the 85 or put up the money for two movies. And if you can't find somebody who'll do that, we're going to make this for one $85 million movie.
He was only willing to let him explore other options, though, because he would still insist on a percentage of whatever the... Right?
Yeah, well, he said, listen, but if I have to sell this to somebody else, I will do it, because that's the deal I'm making with you. But one of the things is going to, I want 5% of first dollar gross for Miramax. And DeLuca and Mark Ordesky, who was a good friend of Peter Jackson's, Peter Jackson wrote a sequel to Nightmare on Elm Street, like the Elm Street 4 or 5 or something like that, yeah. and actually came to Los Angeles to try to pitch it to us. And he ended up getting to be friends with Mark Ordesky and was sleeping on Mark Ordesky's couch and stuff. So they were good. So it was Ordesky and DeLuca came into my office and said, are we interested in Lord of the Rings? I said, absolutely. He said, well, it's available. It's going to be available for 1 week, but I just want to tell you something. You're going to have to give Harvey Weinstein 5%. I said, go fuck yourself. We're not going to give Harvey Weinstein. I'll tell you what, I'll give Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, right.
So they said, they threw up their hands. And they said, we knew that this was your reaction.
Yeah.
And they walked out. But at the same time, DeLuca and I were having some serious disagreements about production decisions. And he and Michael was even more adamant that we weren't doing anything. We weren't making commercial movies anymore. And what happened was that a week later, Ordesky came into my office. He said, Jackson is coming in tomorrow. Would you like to hear? I'm just doing this as a courtesy. Would you sit in on the pitch meeting? So I said, sure, I would. And I did. And I was in personal turmoil about this, my situation with Mike DeLuca. And I sit down and I listen to these guys and watch what they put together, and it was unbelievably exciting. And Peter Jackson, I knew what he had done, but that's a whole other story. But what he had done for this, he said, I can make these movies for $65 million each.
At this point, he's pitching you on just two.
Just two. I mean, three was never mentioned up to this point. And so he said, I can make these two movies. They're going to be $65 to $75 million each, and he did this whole thing with Ian McClellan and a pitch reel, and then they came in with these giant 80 by 100 inch color blow ups of the locations, and I could take or leave locations, but I've never seen anything like this. Mm-hmm. I had no clue what it was like in New Zealand, mm-hmm. and you see things that you just even come a little bit with somewhere in Iceland. I'd never seen anything like this mm-hmm. stuff. And then I'm thinking back about the arguments I'm having with Mike DeLuca, and I'm thinking back about how International is dying to looking for stuff, and they're getting kind of irritated that we're not coming up with international movies. And then I know we have a 100 or 250 or $300 million production budget from Time Warner. And that it's only going to be we have the money to make these movies in our budget, and I misunderstood, but it was going to be over. I thought it was going to be over 3 years, and it turned out we had to make all three of them at once. But mm-hmm. that came out.
That was cost saving, right?
It was because you couldn't. People were going to get old. Yeah. Couldn't wait a year and a half to do it. Anyhow, this is a long story, and to make it short, and I said we desperately need something, and I don't. It's not just one movie I'm going to grab away. It's going to be three. I said to him, that was the classic.
It was your idea. Moment.
I said, I'm sorry.
It was your idea that it be three.
Well, I take five. I mean, it was ridiculous. Well, in fact, some people are doing five.
Right.
But yeah, so I said, well, there are three books. Why don't we do three of them? Because for me, that was three. That was suddenly, it was a shining star for 3 years.
But just to play the devil's advocate here, the downside, which people felt the risk would be, is that if the first one flops, the other two aren't going to do any better, right?
That is correct. Let me fill in the sure. blanks there. Between the pre-sales and the two tax deals, one in Germany and one in New Zealand, mm-hmm. I think we had like 80% of all three pictures covered.
So you guys would have been okay.
So it wasn't going to sink anything.
Right.
However, what you are saying is correct. First of all, we would have had a lot of pissed off buyers internationally. Second of all, those two, the two movies that were the second and third movie that were made were going to be, were going to have to be shown, but they were, because they were done, but they were obviously going to be, not going to be wildly successful. The first one was inept. So it was, that was what the risk was. I mean, you don't get it, anything risk-free, but I mean, this was about, this was almost as good as it gets.
So you go forward with this at a time when, as you mentioned, Little Nicky flopped, Town and Country was not going over very well. You're having these issues with Michael DeLuca. And you released the first one of these in 2001, and then two, and then three. Obviously, we all know how well they were received. Even going back to the 26-minute preview in Cannes, that's when I think the rest of the world caught on that maybe you guys had something really special. What I wanted to ask you, though, is just how you processed from, let's say, opening weekend of the first one, how this was going to change things for you. It obviously goes on to make more money collectively, the trilogy, than I think any other indie movies even came close to ever, with billions of dollars, all the Oscars for the third one. But starting from opening weekend is, I assume, when you realize this is going to change our business.
Yeah, we sort of knew that, with the caveat that this, that Peter Jackson might not have the chops for it.
Yeah.
But he did. He absolutely came through, obviously, with flying colors. And if you had seen his other movies like Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead and stuff like that, that's a whole other story.
Right, right.
But he absolutely came through incredibly well. And he insisted on things, and we supported him across the board. Actually, I think we were some production problems in the third, the Return of the King, and he wanted to cut out one of the sequences because it was going to cost too much. And Michael and I both said, "Leave it in. We want, it's important to the movie. You just keep doing what you're doing, man." Mm-hmm. So I mean, it was just one of those magical things that sometimes happens in business where things just came together the right way.
So, with all the success and Oscar night, how can it be any bigger than when you guys swept all the, I think it was 11 awards for Return of the King, and just all of that, you follow that, now it's not DeLuca, now it's Noah Emmerich, it's Toby Emmerich is your production chief in those next few years, where you've got Elf and Notebook and Monster-in-Law, Wedding Crashers, Little Children, Fine Line becomes Picture House with Pan's Labyrinth. But I wonder if you can just share your interpretation. How does so much change between the Oscars in early 2004, recognizing the whole trilogy essentially, and then the unpleasantness that you guys had to deal with in, I guess it would be 2008, when Bukis and you guys had this parting of ways? What, in your view, happened in those 4 or 5 years to lead to that?
I think what happened, first of all, I think a creative organization should be small. And we, even at that point, had 550 or 600 people. There was a lot of individual hubris and overweening pride altogether that was not healthy. I think that there was a lack of accountability, my fault, because it was not the way I did business. I really believed in and trusted the people that I worked with, and that philosophy worked for a while, but it had gotten too big, and too many people thought they were too indispensable. And then I thought, there was some disagreements that went on between the East Coast and West Coast that were not healthy. And I think that it all came back to Jeff Bukis. There was a chance for us to sell New Line to somebody else, that we were going to buy New Line back because we had a possible financial partner who was going to put up $3 billion we're talking about. It wasn't a number that was actually quoted, but there was a belief that our library was worth that.
Yeah.
It was time to do what they should have done 20 years ago, and say, who are these people and what are they doing in our midst? I mean, do we really want to have guys still running around distributing movies when we have a perfectly capable, ostensibly perfectly capable marketing and sales organization that gets better deals? And what are they doing
here? Brothers, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, what have you done for me lately? What have they got coming up next? I mean, even the movie stars that they get are not the real movie stars that the world wants.
Was there a movie that you think put it over the edge? Was it The Golden Compass? Was it something that was like the last straw?
It was never described to me that way. The Golden Compass was something that I was less enthusiastic about. Even though I completely concurred with it, as Michael did with me, it was really Michael that really was more in favor of it. But it wasn't that it didn't come out. It was a good movie.
Yeah, and it did well internationally, right? But the problem was that, like with Lord of the Rings,
insane.
Yeah,
it did extremely well internationally. Yeah. And then there was this guy in Tennessee or somewhere else who sent things to every Baptist organization, schools, whether they were Baptist by designation or just by, you know, sentiment, that Pullman is anti-God, and that even if the movie, which I was basically me who said, we've got to get this anti-God thing out of here. Yeah. I'm all for anti-authority. That's youthfulness. That's great stuff. But when you don't play with God, so we took as much of that out as we could. And then the response was, yeah, but the kids are going to go to the library to read the books, and then they're going to be irreligious.
And the way it was explained in the press, I don't know if this is correct, but that to make The Golden Compass cost more than the three Lord of the Rings films combined. It was a big bet.
No, it's not.
Not correct?
No. It cost more than any single one.
Right.
I think it cost, Chris Weitz did a quite good job, but there was also this, I wish we had exercised a little bit more budget. We had trouble getting a director that we really wanted. I thought, as I said, Chris was very good for the job, but it cost over $200 million. But the three Lord of the Rings, which I forgot to tell you, is that the first one that Peter Jackson said you could do for $75 million ended up costing $125 or $130. The second one cost, by that time, it didn't really matter that much, I think around $170.
Yeah.
And the third one cost like $190 million.
Oh, my God.
So, but by that time,
it was, off, yeah. So I want to read back to you a quote that I thought was pretty powerful of yours, where this was talking about just, and this is the final New Line question, but just after the meeting with Bukas, where you say, quote, "Now I understand what it's like when factories close. I mean, hundreds of people who had worked for me as long as 25, 26 years are suddenly given an envelope and told to go home. And I was given an envelope and told to go home too, so I know exactly what the feeling is," close quote. Is there any words to describe what that's like? You know, this is
your
baby.
I mean, it was because I was the only one who was exaggerating, because I went home and, believe me, I shed tears. Mm-hmm. But I had worked hard for it, but I made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went home feeling crappy, mm-hmm. and knowing that this is something that I started, and that suddenly, you know, it was, and I had nothing. You could go into the Warner's lot, there's a New Line building there. And, you know, the logo that I designed and everything is, so sure, that makes me feel crappy, but I also have a nice property, and I have, and I'm well situated. Not guaranteed, but I'm well situated for a long time.
Yeah,
and I'm pretty old in the middle of all this too. So it's not like I have to, or I'm going to be able to work another 50 years to do something else. But I saw people, some of whom deserved to be fired anyhow, but weren't. That was something else. But everybody, as I said, it was like a corporate funeral parlor. And I'm very acutely aware of what it's like to work for something and work for somebody and have been an important cog in the machinery to suddenly, you know, get knocked off. It's a terrible thing, and I'm extremely sympathetic, or at least understanding of what happens when, you know, you close a car factory or something like that. These people, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
Well, on your end of things, I think it's amazing that you and Michael immediately, you know, at a time when you could have, either just stayed home and licked your wounds or retired and done whatever, you guys pretty immediately said, we're back in this. We're not done. We're going to start the place where we are right now, Unique Features. And today we're here talking about a movie that in some ways, this is Ambition, your latest one, is in some ways a comment, I think, on or references the whole history that we've been talking about. And what I mean by that is it makes people wonder if what they're seeing is actually real. That goes back to Image. It makes, you know, you're talking about there's A Nightmare on Elm Street is quoted. I think number two is quoted and referenced in the film. Reefer Madness, there's a poster of it in the background. It's sort of for people who know what they're looking at and or looking at or listening to, a trip not just through this violinist experience, but through your own, right?
Yeah, well, it's very possibly a swan song, but that's what's intended.
Yeah.
I mean, it gave some motivation and some emotionality from me to making this movie. And also, it's meant as a niche movie. It's really meant for millennial women. And I think that's still a very unsatisfied niche that could be very, very successful. I don't know if it'll happen with Ambition, but more and more filmmakers are understanding who care about putting entertainment on the table, which is what I care about more than anything else, coming from the food business, mm-hmm. that you ask people to spend an hour and a half or 2 hours of the most valuable thing they have, which is their time, and you want to give those people, the right people, the value for their money.
And you mentioned millennial women. That's pretty much who's at the center of this movie. It's all
millennial women, yes. And I mean, now with the women's movement has taken a whole new, it's gotten a heft and a momentum that I've never seen before.
What do you make of it all? I mean, obviously, on one hand, it's swept out Weinstein, who we've talked about, and a lot of other people, but can you quite believe it? Can you quite wrap your head around all the changes that have happened recently?
No, I feel the business about abusing employees is a terrible thing. I can only use my own perspective. It's just something I couldn't imagine doing, and I wouldn't do it. On the other hand, I have had also people say, well, women never had a chance in the business. I don't understand that, because we've had women...
Donna Langley right now is...
Well, Donna Langley, and there's always been... I've been looking for qualification. That's, you know, you wouldn't choose Peter Jackson either. But it's a little bit too much button pushing going on. But I'm also sympathetic to the stories, and I do know of that many of them are true. It's just that I think it's time to understand. I don't believe in affirmative action. Let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. I guess that makes me into ultra conservative. But I think that people. I believe in merit. And I believe there's an enormous number of females that can do great things, and I'm incredibly impressed with the brain power and creative power that a female perspective can bring to the movie business. And I would do everything I could that was justified for the project. The project is the baby. They're the mother. I'm the mother. We're the creative parents. But as I said, that when you make a movie, you feel like everybody feels, whether it's the grip, the sound department, most everybody who's working out feels a sense of paternity or maternity for what they're doing. And what we're all trying to do is to throw creative genes at this child. And the metaphor I've chosen to use is, it's like you don't know how it's going to get born, if it's going to be a stumble bum on the Bowery, or a captain of industry someplace. But everybody's disappointed when a film doesn't work, and it doesn't matter the color of the skin, the sex of the creator. It's just get the best one you can.
Last question. Earlier this year in March, very sadly, we lost Michael Lynn. And I wonder if that moment and the tributes and everything that's followed has made you think back personally just about all that you two achieved together and his legacy, and how you both, many years from now, hopefully when we're all gone, will be remembered. That what we've talked about here, what you built over the 52 years since New Line was started in that walk-up.
Well, I think about it a lot, but I don't take any more credit than I think I'm due. And I'm kind of hard on myself that way. As I said, I don't know what I would have done if I was decided to go out to Hollywood and get a job with the Sam Markoff. I don't know where. I know a lot of guys who did,
yeah.
And they stumbled around for the rest of their lives.
Right.
I think if I've had any skill, it's just to make the idea of working together an affirmative and enjoyable situation. And I at least am proud of having assembled a group of people who, you know, they've been totally different in all kinds of ways, and I've had to endure. If I've had done anything that really took balls, it was to have had some people that were really hard to work with and made my life completely miserable. But so what? I mean, I'm still standing, and I give thanks to those people.
Well, thank you so much. This has really been special. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
It was a real compliment.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporters Podcast Network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.